Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and as always, you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. A lot of my friends and contacts and fans of the show have been asking me how President Chavez of Venezuela is since he had a recent struggle or battle with cancer. So we're going to bring on the expert of all things Venezuelan, our good friend Ava Golinger. Ava, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Well, we always want to have you on whenever there's a lot of concern or things happening in Venezuela. And I have, you know, so many fans of the show and supporters and contacts who have been very, very concerned about the health of President Chavez. Can you give us an update on that?
Well, President Chavez is presently undergoing chemotherapy treatment. He is in Cuba, which is where his initial cancer was detected in a very unexpected way. I mean, well, I guess nobody ever really expects it, and he, of course, certainly didn't. I mean, Chavez is very young. He's almost 57 years old, and he's never really had any major health problems. There's not cancer in his family that is known, so it wasn't an issue that was of concern in general in terms of his health. However, he is someone who works incredibly hard, has been in office for 12 years, elected twice, and, you know, works nonstop, has never taken a vacation, doesn't take sick days, and is incredibly dedicated and committed to his work. I mean, and, you know, that's just been his sort of rhythm throughout the past decade or so. And so now it's caught up to him. His health has taken a toll on his ability to, you know, continue that level of work that he's been doing as president of Venezuela. And when the cancer was detected initially, which was in June, about mid-June, what was found was a pelvic abscess, which was immediately drained. And after the infection subsided, they found a mass of malignant cancer cells. And so that was immediately removed. It was a very intense operation. It took 6.5 hours. You can imagine that level of surgery, you know, the cutting through all of his muscle, the type of wound that he had after that. And so since that time, which was the 20th of June, was that operation, he's been recovering from that and waiting to be able to have another, you know, revision done, thorough revision of his body, and then to start the chemo. So the latest update, which Chavez made public himself, was that no further cancer cells have been detected in his body. So the tumor was taken out in its entirety, and nothing seems to have been left behind. Of course, the chemotherapy treatments are a precaution to prevent the cancer from coming back. So that's what he's doing. He delegated some of his administrative functions to the executive vice president, Elias Hawa, and to the minister of finance and planning, Jorge Giordani. But it's really administrative in nature, and Chavez remains at the head of government. I mean, they activated actually an electronic signature before he left for Cuba so he can himself still sign documents. And he's regularly involved, you know, in Venezuela, Cindy. Twitter is a really big deal, and Chavez is one of the leading tweeters. And so every day since he's been in Cuba, he's been tweeting several times a day, starting in the early morning hours, because now he's getting up at like 5 in the morning. So he's sending out tweets from that time on throughout the day. And, you know, I mean, it makes people feel and believe that, of course, he is following everything that's going on, and he's still fully capacitated to remain as president.
Well, there's always, well, not always, but for quite a while, there's been a very active opposition to the revolution and the administration of President Chavez. And how is that opposition trying to take advantage of this illness?
Well, it's really rather grotesque. I mean, they've from the beginning first were doubting the fact that he was even diagnosed with cancer, was sick, thought it was all a ploy, a strategy for his reelection. Venezuela has presidential elections in 2012, so the campaigns, some of them have already been started. Chavez's candidacy has already been launched by his party, the PSUV, and so, you know, the opposition were trying to make up stories and myths and rumors about speculating about his health, one saying that it was false, and then on the other side saying that he's terminally ill and going to be out of the picture soon, which isn't true either. So, and on top of that, there has been external aid to try to urge opposition figures and groups and organizations to try to promote a climate of chaos and destabilization in order to permit another coup d'etat to be executed against President Chavez. And in fact, just this week, the Miami Herald Spanish language version, which is the Nuevo Herald, published a front page article basically calling on the Venezuelan opposition to, you know, organize conditions for a coup, and also asking for help from the U.S. government to make sure that it happens and is successful, saying this is the time to take advantage of the situation, take advantage of Chavez's weakness, you know, and execute the coup before it's too late. And, you know, making up all kinds of stories about secession, that Chavez is preparing a double. I mean, they're really, you know, fantasizing about things that are not happening and that have never happened. I mean, this has been an ongoing situation in Venezuela with an unfortunate opposition that is not willing to work within the framework of democracy. So that's what's been going on. And then at the same time, there's been another sector of the opposition saying, well, Chavez is, since Chavez is sick and undergoing medical treatment, then he should just be, you know, inhabilitated from being president and should delegate all his power and authority to the vice president, who should temporarily take over, which is ridiculous because Chavez is not incapacitated mentally and he's fully in front of government affairs and involved in everything as he always has been and will continue to be. So, and then they've also tried to say his absence from the country, which has been authorized by Venezuela's parliament, the National Assembly, is something illegal, even though it's not, because it's been authorized in a legal way. But the opposition says, well, he's out of the country, so he's not governing, so therefore, you know, there's a power vacuum, which isn't true either. And, I mean, it's not the first time, you know, I would remind listeners that, for example, U.S. President Ronald Reagan had three cancers during his presidency. He underwent major surgery for colon cancer right before he was reelected in 1985. And there is some evidence to show that, in fact, many of his treatments and surgeries were conducted in Germany. So they didn't even take place in the United States. I mean, so I mean, it's not unusual. There have been several presidents in Latin America, for example, recently. The president of Paraguay, Fernando Lugo, had cancer, lymphomic cancer, and he's been cured. And that was just recently while he was in the presidency, as he still is. And then Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, also had the same type of cancer before she was elected president. She underwent treatment and was successfully elected president. So, you know, the treatments are out there. As long as you catch it before it's too late, which is what appears to be the case of President Chavez, then, I mean, he should fully recover, and there's no reason why, you know, the opposition should try to convince public opinion internationally that Chavez isn't governing and that there's a power vacuum.
Has there been any response from the U.S. about his illness or calls to help in overthrowing his government?
Well, the United States government, of course, is being incredibly cautious in this scenario. Chavez is considered a foe by the State Department particularly, but by, of course, all of the U.S. government. And so they're playing this one, you know, pretty slowly, patiently, looking at the scenario, seeing what's going on, at least on the public light. Now, in terms of what's going on behind the scenes, I would say certainly there are efforts and negotiations going on with the opposition groups that the U.S. government has been funding now for years with U.S. taxpayer dollars trying to promote Chavez's overthrow. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly I'm sure there's a sort of unspoken encouragement of anything that could remove Chavez from power. And the fact that, I mean, the Miami Herald was citing Roger Noriega, who's a known figure, you know, very closely linked to the U.S. government now for decades and was part of the Bush administration, was part of the Reagan administration. Unfortunately, even though he has incredibly ridiculous concepts of what's happening in Latin America, he tends to have influence over those who are in power. And so he's one of the ones that's been calling directly for Chavez's overthrow now that Chavez has been diagnosed with cancer and saying the U.S. government should immediately send support, not just financially, but also militarily, to ensure that that happens.
Well, what would be the difference between that and between what the U.S. is doing in Libya right now?
Well, there's really not much difference. I mean, the case of Libya is outrageous. The fact that not only did a bombing campaign begin against a country that wasn't a threat to anybody else, and I mean, in terms of being a threat to a foreign nation, that those nations that have been attacking it and bombing it now for months. But then on top of that, when the U.S. government and its NATO allies were unable to kill Gaddafi, basically assassinate Gaddafi, which was the overall objective, and or invoke regime change, now they're installing, you know, a completely illegitimate parallel government. So, yeah, I mean, those are the types of scenarios that are incredibly dangerous precedents being set today that can be used or applied to other countries like Venezuela. And I would just remind also listeners again that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, and it's just been recertified again by OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, that Venezuela is number one in terms of oil reserves. So this, of course, makes it a huge target of the world's most powerful interests.
Well, there's similar also parallels between Libya and Venezuela in that both of the countries use their wealth, their natural resources or their oil wealth to improve lives of their citizens. And that means that the U.S. oil companies and British oil companies can't reap most of the profit like they did before Chavez was elected in Venezuela in 1998.
That's absolutely correct. And, I mean, a lot of people don't know that actually Libya has the highest standard of living of all African nations. And without passing judgment on its government, I mean, there have been policies that have invested in social well-being over decades now. And in the case of Venezuela, of course, it's new under the Chavez administration over the past decade, these policies of using oil profits to invest back into the people, invest back into the infrastructure and development of the country. And as of right now, at a normal sort of expected rate of income from oil sales, Venezuela invests the government, because obviously oil is nationalized, the government invests 60% of all profits directly into social programs relating to healthcare, education, you know, housing initiatives, job training programs. And then there was a new windfall tax law just enacted last year, which, because of the, you know, increasing oil prices, says basically that if oil is over $90 a barrel, which it is right now, then 90% of oil profits coming into Venezuela are going to be invested into social programs. So, I mean, it's really a majority of the money that's coming in is being used to invest back into the people, and it's had tremendous effect. Poverty has been reduced in Venezuela by over 50% in the past decade. I mean, that's an immense change right there. You know, we have universal, free, accessible, quality health care for everybody. No one is asked for insurance cards or turned away or, you know, left to die if they can't afford to pay for health care, because there are, you know, free quality clinics everywhere that have just been built over the past few years. Education at all levels is accessible and it's free, you know, public education. And yeah, the same goes for a whole wide variety of other programs in terms of supermarkets that have subsidized products to combat inflation, speculation in the private markets, which is a big problem in Venezuela. And yeah, I mean, obviously that's not something that is seen in any way as favorable to multinationals and foreign interests. And especially because in the case of Venezuela, I mean, there have been strict controls implemented on multinationals operating in Venezuela over the past decade that existed before but were never really implemented, such as, you know, making foreign corporations that are involved in the oil industry pay taxes and royalties on their profits. I mean, things that are normal anywhere else. In Venezuela, which operated like a U.S. colony, you know, those types of initiatives were never obligatory before. Now they are. And mm-hmm. So, you know, companies working in Venezuela just have to abide by the law. It's pretty straightforward as long as they're willing to do it. But when they were used to acting above the law, you know, then of course they've reacted to these types of policies, and it's not convenient to powerful interests that try to exploit and basically, you know, take as much as they can get out of resource wealthy nations like Venezuela.
Well, was that one of the reasons for the first coup attempt in April of 2002? I hope it was the first and only coup attempt. I don't want to seem like there's another one coming. But didn't right before it happened, the National Assembly passed laws to nationalize more of the oil production, or the oil production and profits from it under the National Oil Company in Venezuela?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, oil was nationalized in 1976 in Venezuela, so way before Chavez became president. And after he was in office and there was a whole initiative for constitutional reform under a new constitution that was drafted and ratified in a national referendum by everybody in Venezuela eligible to vote, new laws were implemented. And one of those relating to hydrocarbons, the oil industry, was dealing with what I was just talking about in terms of, you know, making sure that foreign companies operating in Venezuela are paying their royalties or paying their taxes, cannot have more than a 49% share in any kind of joint venture with Venezuela's state oil company. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be a nationalized product if foreign nationals can have higher stakes than the national company. And so, yeah, there was a restructuring of the industry. It affected foreign interests as well as those nationally of the Venezuelan elite, the economic elite that was running the industry like a private company, pocketing most of the profits and embezzling them outside of the country to buy their big homes throughout, you know, Miami and New York and the Caribbean islands. And so right before actually the coup took place in April 2002, President Chavez had changed the entire board of directors of PDVSA, which is the state oil company. And that was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, that set things finally into motion that had been building up anyway, you know, with support from the U.S., of course, and other interested parties in terms of trying to get Chavez out of power. And what Chavez did, in fact, was once he was back in office after the coup was defeated by the people of Venezuela and he was rescued and returned to power to his legitimate office, was that he reinstated that entire board of directors in an attempt to reconcile and to, you know, basically extend an olive branch to the opposition, which mm-hmm. was a giant mistake because mm-hmm. they weren't looking to reconcile or to work with him. They were looking to get him out of office no matter what. And months after the coup and after he reinstated the board back to PDVSA, they initiated a very extensive and very damaging economically strike in the oil industry where they basically shut it down and sabotaged the entire industry. And Venezuela lost over $20 billion in just a little over two months. And after that happened, which it was an illegal strike anyway, but they also sabotaged like all the equipment. The industry had to be rescued manually. It was functioning originally in an automated way, but since everything had been sabotaged, codes had been switched, you know, there had been control remotely that was basically running the system from the United States, and so everything had to be restructured entirely, and all those that were involved, because they violated their contracts, were out of the industry forever, basically. So, yeah, it played an immense role in the beginning years of the Chavez administration in terms of all the destabilization that was going on. And now, of course, the industry is pretty firmly under the control, as it should be, of the state. But there are still pockets that exist within it. It's a very, you know, extensive company that sabotage. And, you know, it's Venezuela's lifeblood. So, of course, it's the most vulnerable part of the government is the oil industry. And the fact, even more so today, that those profits are used for all the social programs in the country. So it's always the target. And that's why just in May 24th, the State Department imposed sanctions against Venezuela's oil company, PDVSA, even though the sanctions really have no teeth at all. They're just sending a message to the world that it's dangerous to do business with Venezuela, which is what the State Department actually declared about the sanctions. So, yeah, they're always
except
looking for ways to attack and debilitate it.
Except the U.S. is still buying oil from Venezuela.
That's correct.
The U.S. can't do business with Venezuela. But But those sanctions were put on because of some transactions with Iran, I guess. And I think how rude of Venezuela to put Venezuela's interests over the interests of the United States.
Well, actually, that is precisely the mentality of those running the U.S. government. So,
right.
And, in fact, beyond that, imposing internal U.S. legislation on other countries, which is not even legitimate under international law. I mean, a U.S. law has no jurisdiction or bearing on another country. Yet the U.S., because they have the capacity to impose pressure via, you know, economic means or political means, tend to use their legislation to influence other countries, and other countries often, you know, abide by what the U.S. is requesting. In the case of Venezuela, you know, Venezuela is a sovereign state and has declared itself so and remains so and will remain so. And President Chavez is pretty adamant about the fact that, you know, Venezuela is no longer a colony of the U.S. Venezuela has the right to have its own relations with any country in the world, just like the United States does. And, you know, those sanctions, as far as Venezuela is concerned, have absolutely no legality whatsoever.
Well, absolutely. And that brings up a couple of questions. And I think that there are challenges to the, you know, the continued viability of the Bolivarian Revolution and what's happening in Venezuela. The first one is many people, supporters of Chavez and the revolution, their question is, if something does happen to him, is the revolution strong enough to continue without, you know, the leadership that he's provided?
Well, President Chavez, of course, is a very charismatic and powerful leader. There's no denying that whatsoever. And, of course, his leadership has been crucial in uniting different sectors and organizations of Venezuelan society to build this revolution. But at the same time, the revolution was in motion before Hugo Chavez came to power. And the revolution in Venezuela is really something that is being built and is being maintained and being advanced by the people of Venezuela. So while, yes, his leadership, of course, is important, it would be very difficult to imagine Venezuela taking a step backwards instead of continuing to advance forward. Of course, if Chavez were no longer president at some point, which, of course, he won't be president forever, that's not the objective or a possibility. So someone else will be in power in Venezuela someday, and certainly, I mean, things will change in terms of that particular aspect of the revolution and that level of leadership. But, I mean, one of the main objectives of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela has been transferring power to the people. And that entire concept is based on the notion that people eventually are, or the people of Venezuela are going to be those who are, you know, basically running their country and are implementing all the different policies and initiatives. And so while, yes, again, I mean, Chavez's leadership is still very important, there's a whole new generation of Venezuelans that have been growing up in a different model over the past decade, that have a different vision of their country, that have a stronger identity. You know, their identity has been recovered, has been dignified as being Venezuelans because of this particular revolution. And so, therefore, I think that there's an entire generation of leaders that are growing up in Venezuela and that are going to be the ones, you know, running the show. And so while everybody would love Chavez to be around, those that support him, as long as he can be, I don't think it's a question of, well, if he's no longer there, then there's no more revolution. I mean, then that would mean there's never been a revolution. So I think that absolutely things will continue. They will change, obviously, in terms of the dynamics, but there's no question. I mean, this is a revolution of the people, and the people will continue to be the ones that are changing and transforming their country.
Okay, so I just really want to thank you for your time and all the information that you always bring to the show. And the last question would be, an economy based on oil is always, you know, very unstable. I mean, it's good right now. There's been many years when it hasn't been good. And so that means that the economy fluctuates based on its oil. What steps is Venezuela taking to transition itself off of an economy based on fossil fuels?
Well, the Venezuelan government has been trying to diversify industry in the country now, and that's really the next sort of phase of this transformation of the country, of this revolution, building new industry, focusing on Venezuela is not just oil wealthy, but also has a wide variety of minerals and metals in the country that are now also being produced. And the idea is not just to produce raw materials, but also to build factories in Venezuela so that Venezuela can produce products like automobiles and all kinds of a whole slew of other industries and products. So there's a diversification in that sense of industry, and then there's also a focus again on agriculture, which was abandoned in the early 20th century because of the focus on oil. So Venezuela is rebuilding its agricultural industry in order to reduce dependence on imports, but also to become, a power in terms of agricultural production. And so to have a wide variety of products for export as well as, to supply the people of Venezuela. And at the same time, though, Venezuela has the largest reserves, and even though someday they'll dry up, they're at least going to be around for another 100 or so years. When they're drying up all throughout the Middle East, they're still going to be in Venezuela. And Venezuela also has a large amount of water reserves, which, of course, many say is the next major target of powerful interests around the world.
Right.
So. Yeah, there are a lot of initiatives going on to decrease dependence on oil as the only product that Venezuela produces. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and I think we as a people have to decrease our dependence on oil and oil-based products also. Just one last thing. I'd like you to talk about the new housing project in Venezuela. I think that's a very exciting thing that the government and the people are getting involved in right now.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful initiative called Grand Mission Housing Venezuela, and it's a government program that is involving, millions of people as well in terms of creating the program itself, training those as part of the mission. Housing Venezuela is also a mission work, a social program in terms of creating jobs, and the idea is to provide job training to people so that they can take part and build cooperatives or create cooperatives to be involved in the construction of the more than 2 million homes that are being built in Venezuela presently and are expected to be completed in their totality within the next 6 years. And the idea is to address, of course, the housing crisis, the long-term housing crisis that exists in Venezuela. And, there's a big difference, for example, in the way that housing crises have been handled in the United States and in the case of Venezuela. In the case of the United States, the government bailed out banks and bailed out financial institutions, insurance companies, mortgage institutions, and let all the people who lost their homes just left them on the streets, no help to them. Whereas in the case of Venezuela, it's been the exact opposite. We've also had scandals with companies that have committed fraud, that have scammed people, real estate companies scamming people, banks also that have also committed fraud and have been, mismanaging funds. Most of the banks involved in any kind of illicit activity were actually liquidated in Venezuela, were intervened by the state, either liquidated or nationalized. Customer savings were all protected. And in the case of the housing industry, those companies involved in any kind of fraud have also been mainly nationalized or somehow taken over, expropriated. And the housing programs are all continuing in order to ensure that no one loses their home or their future home in the case of construction projects. And so, and there's also been a problem last year. We had heavy rains, left over 130,000 people homeless because of the flooding. And so those have been the first priority in terms of providing homes. And what the state is doing is ensuring homes are available, so many are being built because the housing doesn't exist. So apartments, homes all throughout the country being built by state, joint, private, and public enterprises. And then the homes will be distributed on a need basis dealing first with those who are left displaced by the rains. It's not something that's just a gift. You know, they're examining every person, every family individually, and seeing what's their income capacity. So do they have the capacity to put down a 5% deposit, a 10% deposit, a 30% deposit, no deposit, you know, so then no down payment, I mean. So no down payment is necessary if the person or the family can't afford it. And then they're given a low-interest loan, a very low-interest loan, under 5%, you know, to be able to pay off the cost of the housing. And the housing, depending also on the income, is if the person has basically below poverty line or at poverty line, then the government will subsidize 70% of it, so the loan will only be for 30%, which the person or family has to pay. And so it's on an individual basis. There are brigades all throughout the country going door to door for visiting the people that signed up for the program and are, you know, evaluating each case. And it's also applying to those that already have homes but need renovations, that have problems with the internal structure, and so the government will provide a subsidy to be able to do that. I mean, so the idea overall is, you know, the government of Venezuela wants its people to be healthy and happy and stable. And as everyone knows, having your own home is a huge part of feeling safe in your residence, in your country. And so Venezuela puts people before profits. Right. And this is another sign of that.
Well, Ava, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we really appreciate your work and your time and coming on and sharing all of this information for us.
Well, thank you, Cindy. Anytime.
That was Ava Golinger. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you return next week. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, our guest, Ava Golinger, and you for listening. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Peace out.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. Get up now. I want
want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs!
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.